Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, hanging gardens, great pyramids, and other superstructures were celebrated as wonders of the world. And like days of the week and deadly sins, there were always seven of them. More recent Magnificent Sevens have included man-made marvels such as Machu Picchu, the Taj Mahal, or wonders of nature such as the Grand Canyon and the Great Barrier Reef. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guests in this podcast. And the guest I'm asking today is the writer and journalist Charles Moore, more formally the Right Honourable Baron Moore of Etchingham. In newspapers and magazines, Lord Moore has enjoyed a distinguished career as a political commentator and columnist, and at different times he's been the editor of the Daily Telegraph, the Sunday Telegraph, and the Spectator. In hardcovers, he's published an impressive three-volume authorised biography of Margaret Thatcher. All of which, Charles, gives us a clear enough indication you're well to the right of centre in your political thinking, but I notice you're described as non-affiliated when you're sitting in the House of Lords. Is the modern Conservative Party too centrist for you, or too incompetent, or what?
Neither of those things. Being a working journalist, I think it's better to not to be under the whip of any party in the Lords. In fact, the whips in the Lords are very light things, but people won't believe that you're saying what you think if you take a party whip. And, you know, it's very important to me to be able to say what I think.
All right. So that allows you to criticise particular policies or particular ministers or whatever. But broadly speaking, would it be fair to say you support the Conservative cause in most instances?
Not really. I'm very much a Conservative, but with a small c. Mm. I suppose you could say I was a Tory in the sense of that's an attitude of mind as opposed to a party thing.
Yes. I was going to describe your think of you. I would think of you as a traditionalist. You tend to stick to the old ways in many things. And I think some of your wonders are going to come to in a moment to reinforce me in that opinion.
You might be right. I think you are right. But I'm also very in favour. One of the reasons I'm very interested in Margaret Thatcher, and we'll come to that, I'm sure, is that she was a great innovator. Mm. And so that being a traditionist doesn't mean that you can't innovate or that you're against innovation.
Yes. I was thinking about this readiness to talk to you. I was thinking of a quote that I've always had in my mind that G.K. Chesterton said that tradition is the democracy of the dead. But in fact, what he said was a rather more nuanced thing than that. He said you've got to balance tradition with innovation, to use your word there. You've got to take into account your father's opinion, even though he's dead, but also your groom or your servant or your any ordinary person, not neglect those views simply because you might consider not as well educated. I think I'm paraphrasing.
Yes, that's absolutely
opinion.
Right. And Edmund Burke talked of a compact between the dead, living, and the yet unborn. And yes, I think that's a good way to look at human life.
All right.
Society.
Well, just so that in case people are listening to this aren't completely au fait with you and your life, I'm not going to go through a lot, but it sounds like you've had quite a gilded career in a way. You were at Eton, which is one of the top schools, then you were at Trinity College, Cambridge, and then you pretty rapidly made your way in the world of journalism. I think you were writing Daily Telegraph leaders when you were about, 22 or something.
I began as a reporter on the Telegraph in 1979, was then briefly a sub, and then became a leader writer. And then I left for The Spectator in 1982 and became the political columnist there, then the editor. So it was quite a lot of stuff compressed into quite a short time.
Sure. And not too much of, knocking on the doorstep with a notebook.
Yes, but I did do reporting, and I've, thank goodness I did. because that is the primary thing about journalism, is a story. And since I stopped editing, though I've mainly done columns, I've done the odd big story, which I find extremely satisfying, and that is the best, that is the heart of it.
Right, OK. Well, I don't want to foreshadow too much that's going to emerge, in, I hope, in your wonders, but your, what's your first wonder of the world that you're going to introduce to me or to describe to me?
Well, I bore in mind that you want it to be personal, and therefore perhaps this isn't a wonder of the world, but it's certainly a wonder of my world, which is hops. The reason that I think of hops is, first of all, I was a proto-real ale boar when I was a young man. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit more of a wine man now. But I also brought up among hops. And so the smell and appearance of them, and indeed the architecture of where I live in Sussex and where I was brought up, are very much part of that. I'm just old enough to remember the last hop picking on our farm. And it was the last sort of communal activity of the village, really, in agricultural terms. So what seemed to me at the probably it was only 20 people, but it seemed a vast crowd of people at the time picking the hops in what they called hop gardens. And this I remember. And hops, of course, the purpose of them is, this purpose, is to flavour beer and also to, as a natural preservative. And so I'm always very fascinated by how something that grows can be turned into something industrial which produces pleasure. And this is obviously true of grapes. But with hops, they're not intrinsic to beer, like grapes are intrinsic to wine. They are, they're sort of brought in as an additional to beer. The beer used to be produced without hops, but hops add the taste and the preservation. And so there's this rather marvellous sort of ecology of the hop. Or the hops, I should say.
Well, I think it was the case that there was a time when what was called ale didn't have hops in it, and hops made it into beer. I think the terms have got intermingled now, and they were a bit of an innovation a few centuries ago, and it was first resisted a bit in Britain or in England, that what's this foreign thing, but it's been a few centuries now.
Yes, I think
now
they came from Germany originally. They're very attractive to look at, both when dried and when growing. And the dried bit's interesting because, of course, that's what has to happen to them when they're pressed and made ready for their use. But what it means is that a lot of people have hops in their house dried, and they're very decorative in that form.
And they
twist.
Yes.
And indeed, the word people used to use for how you made them grow in a twisted way was twiddle, which I think then spread to wider currency.
Right.
So you twiddled the hops.
Well, when you talk about hop picking, of course, that used to have a very established thing in its way. People from London, you know, the East End of London, used to have it. It was almost a holiday for them, though it was a working holiday, quite a hard working holiday, to go down to Kent or wherever else and live in a caravan for a couple of weeks and pick hops. Is that what you're talking about, the 20 people?
Actually, no, because there were two types of hop picking. One was, lots and lots of little farms like ours had hop gardens, and they would just use local labour.
Yeah.
But then there were the bigger hop gardens where they would use the type of labour you described, and this was really a lot of people sometimes. Mm. And it was a great thing for East End people. And though their conditions were often pretty bad, on the whole, the record of the hop gardens and that hop picking was of pleasure, because, I mean, very hard work, but it was a sort of like a holiday, as you say, and it meant that people met one another, they fell in love with one another, they drank together, they had their sort of hop ceremonies and songs, and it was a great encounter with the countryside for people who were poor and urban. So I think it had a great effect, and it even had its own currency, because you got paid, you often didn't get paid in money, you got paid in hop tokens with the stamp of the farmer. And then you would take the token off, and it was worth currency. They still exist. I mean, it can't be used anymore, but you can still find them. And you would go into a pub or whatever and produce your hop token, and off you went.
I wonder if that was a good system. Did you get more or less money by doing that? This crops up in a couple of George Orwell novels. He obviously went on one of these hop-picking expeditions as an observer and really reflecting on the harshness of life for people doing this as a break from East End life.
That's right, and I bet he was right. But I think it's also the case that there was an excitement in hop picking for the people who pick the hops, and a communal aspect. And all I remember, actually remember personally, is the excitement of the village in the activity. It's the nearest thing to the grape harvest in a Mediterranean country. Or indeed, now, of course, we have grape harvest in Britain. But
yes, probably fewer hops, more grapes. But you said this, that you remember the last one. So has it gone now? Is it a mechanical thing now?
Well, first of all, it's mechanical. But secondly, the system's changed. So it's much more internationally competitive, and Britain has lost out. And all little farms had what they called a hop quota. And you could sell your quota. And these were brought up by the big brewers like Whitbread or something and consolidated. So this idea of there being little hop gardens all over the place, all in hundreds and hundreds of farms in Kent and Sussex, that's all come to an end. But the architecture's still there because the oast houses, which are a very apparent feature of with their white cowls, remain and tend to be converted. But I just remember them being used to dry the press and then dry the hops, and the hot air would come up through the hops and out of the cowl, hence the shape.
As a brewery, hops are hugely important to a lot of what we produce here. And I think over the years, people have got used to the fact there've been so many hops that they get released, and new hops being released all the time. You know, really, if you look at since 2014.
What's your second wonder?
Well, I said Fleet Street because I was in Fleet Street, actually physically Fleet Street, when I began as a journalist. And it's very interesting because in those days, as with so many other things, an activity would take place in one place, like Covent Garden Vegetable Market or the City of London, indeed, with money and banking and so on. And therefore, they had a very strong atmosphere of their own, which largely doesn't exist now in most trades because they're dispersed and because of delivery and the internet and so on. And so there I was in this actual Fleet Street, which had been occupied by printers for more than 200 years already by the time I got there. So you could go to the pub which Dr. Johnson went to, and you could feel the sense of a sort of literary and journalistic tradition and an actual industrial tradition, because the print shop was inside the office. So you, at the back of the office would be all our hot metal printing, which was Victorian and was still going on 100% when I was there.
I remember because I was not in Fleet Street, except I was a barrister. So with the temple abuts onto Fleet Street. So once you walk into it, there was the Daily Telegraph building, the Daily Express building. The Daily Mail had papers coming out the back, and the Evening Standard. And there were others who'd gone just a little bit away. And of course, the whole style of that, as you're coming to, you know, people would drink in pubs together. Having filed their copy at, 12, they go off to lunch, which, again, I don't think it works like that anymore, does it, in journalism?
Yes, no, I remember people like you. I don't think I met you in a bar at the time, Clive, but I used to see barristers in Elvino, for example. There was a lot of them. And then we went to a terrible pub called the King and Keys, just beside the Telegraph, where it was sort of hell, really. And the atmosphere was very, very different. There was so much drinking, and almost in reporting, not so much in features, almost 100% male.
Yes. And
you probably didn't file your copy at 12 noon. Actually, you probably hadn't done anything by 12 noon. And then you would drink at lunch, and then you would start filing when you had drunk quite a lot, and then you would go and drink again in the early evening when you had filed. And sometimes you going to check your copy at the last minute as well. So then you drink again and then go back in again.
Yes.
So you could easily work quite hard and still be drinking for about 5 hours a day, I would say, or four.
Mm. Well, old people sometimes think the world is going to the dogs because of the way young people behave. But I think any young person hearing about this for the first time, and it wouldn't just apply to journalism either, lots of businesses, trades, industries seem to operate on this basis, that you squeezed in a bit of work between a long lunch or an early evening drink, which would be, I mean, not on moral grounds exactly, but sort of unimaginable on productivity grounds today.
I mean, there were some very lazy people, but it's surprising how much got done. But, I mean, your phrase going to the dogs was correct. It was going to the dogs. It couldn't last much longer, and we could all see that because papers that were great market leaders, like the Daily Telegraph, were not actually making money because of so-called Spanish practices and overmanning and the refusal to change to new technology. And in came Mrs. Thatcher and changed the law, and the technology changed, trade union law, and the technology changed. And so by the middle of the 1980s, Fleet Street as a physical entity was over, really. So I saw the last of this, and I absolutely loved it because I was new and it was exciting. But, I mean, it was a boulevard of broken dreams, and it was an immense number of dotty and hopeless people, and the practices were quite extraordinary, and the printers were absolutely outrageous, because I actually remember seeing a notice in the print shop of the Telegraph at the back, which said any member having a son or nephew wishing to have a job should apply to X, and so it was a completely hereditary trade, and 100% male, and sort of cockney, and they were the aristocracy of the working class, really. And they would, because they worked it out to their advantage, they were very clever and amusing people, by the way, they would frequently not be down. They'd run whole other things like minicab firms and that sort of thing, in the very ample spare time they negotiated for themselves. And sometimes they would down tools in the middle of the night, and the only way they could be persuaded to go back to work and print was if the management came onto the shop floor, which you could only do with their permission, with suitcases full of money, cash. And they would then open the suitcases and hand out tenors, and they'd all go back to work. And so obviously this couldn't really go on much longer.
Well, I suppose that, yes, it's a funny world that you're describing. I suppose at one end there's the aristocracy and their sons going to Eton, going to, if I may say so, Cambridge, Oxford. And at the other end, you've got the printers operating a very similar system, hereditary principle as well.
I would say the printers were more hereditary than us journalists. But the other thing that was very striking, and I'm interested that I could just see the last of this, was that the people running everything, particularly at the Telegraph, because they tend to be quite old, had all been in the war. And so they had a very different... Bill Deeds was my editor, who'd won the MC in the war. And sometimes there were quite old people walking around, working in the Telegraph, and you couldn't work out what they were doing. I remember asking, they said, why does this chap have this office? He doesn't seem to do anything. And they said, well, he was one of the few, meaning the RAF. And they sort of got a job for life in a way because of that. And so that atmosphere, which is very, very unlike modern life, because there's a sense of sort of what you were owed because of something you'd done, rather than just getting through your normal work, was very important and in some ways attractive and in some ways quite impossible, because there was people who were absolutely incompetent.
I suppose the person who really cut through in Fleet Street terms was Rupert Murdoch, because he built a whole new printing place in Wapping, sort of on the sly, and suddenly everything got switched over there before anybody could prevent it happening, and that cut through all these Spanish practices, as you call them.
You're quite right, and it was one of the great failures of my trade not to be too lazy to work out what Murdoch was up to. He said he was put the print in to produce a new evening paper. And we were very idle about inquiring. And we actually, he managed to pull off this ambush in which nobody knew until the weekend it happened that it was happening. And what it was he's moving the entire operation to Wapping, sacking all the printers and using workers from different unions to come in and work the computers. And there was this tremendous siege and violence and all rest of it, but he won. And though it was unpleasant, I'm very glad he did win, because otherwise print journalism would not have survived.
Well, I take it, yes, you say you're glad now, obviously. I wonder, at the time, were you rather scared by this? Did you think, oh no, what's this Australian, as I think he was at that point, is he going to disrupt everything so much that the whole
I was against Mr. Murdoch in some ways, for example, his hostility to the monarchy, but I was in favour, I was very much in favour of him doing this, because it did seem to me quite ridiculous that you couldn't modernise in the union practices and the technology. So actually, I wasn't always a great admirer of the papers he produced, but I was a great admirer of his courage in doing this. But you're right, of course, a lot of people were very, very anxious and thought that here's this Australian interloper. But actually, you had to have some such interloper, I think.
Right. OK. Not everybody people who are not involved in journalism, they're not going to immediately applaud the idea of how wonderful Fleet Street is, because whatever its achievements in reporting things, undercovering scandals and so forth, especially in the last few years, it's become very, very unpopular because of the, you know, phone hacking and the tittle-tattle, the gossip, the intrusion, whether it's the Leveson Report or anybody, you know, Meghan Markle complaining about it. Everybody has got a complaint about, oh, that story in the papers, they misquoted me, they've lied about me, they got that wrong. Do you ever worry about that? Because American papers, which I would say probably a bit duller than our newspapers, but they're a bit stronger on things like fact-checking and getting things, you know, more accurate. Do you ever worry about that from that point of view?
Yes, of course, because... absolutely, and some papers are notorious for that. But I think the power of an interest in newspapers does fundamentally rely on their being true. I mean, if they really weren't true, like the Sunday Sport really isn't true, then there just is no point in them. So the reason powerful and famous people fear the press is not fundamentally because it's inaccurate, but because it's accurate. That's what's really worrying to them. However, that's no defence for the inaccuracy and the bias, and they do exist and always have.
It's a sort of pile-on. When somebody decides somebody's unpopular, then suddenly there's loads of stories, and their best friend's neighbour is found to give some quotes.
Certainly is a pile-on, but actually, because Fleet Street is politically plural and lots of different owners and things, they usually don't all pile on the same person in the same way. There's usually a counter to, in one paper, to what's some atrocity committed in another.
A street that's never quiet within, but as another day dawns, outwardly comes to life.
Fleet Street, famously steeped in the history of journalism, but no longer actual journalists. Now, the last two journalists working on the street are being made redundant, marking the end of an era.
It all started in a house near this spot in 1702.
And let's go on to your third wonder, which if I may mention what it is, because this does fit in with perhaps a traditionalist view of the world. You've put hunting as a wonder of the world.
Yes, and by hunting, I don't mean it in the American sense, including shooting, though I enjoy shooting as well. I mean the hunting, ideally of live quarry by hounds. Of course, in most circumstances, that's not allowed in Britain today, though it is allowed in Ireland. So now there's trail hunting where you follow a trail, hounds follow a trail, and it tries to replicate hunting, which it does quite successfully, actually. But it, of course, not much use to anybody because the whole point was to control the fox population without exterminating it. So that's what I'm talking about. Usually followed on horseback, but it doesn't have to be.
So in the main, if I've got a picture in my mind of a group of people on horseback in, I'm going to say they're in red outfits, but they're called pink, aren't they? Pink jackets, a pack of hounds, and somewhere in the distance a fox, which is eventually going to be chased down and put to death. That's a sort of the picture I've got of what hunting is, you mean?
Yes, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be red coats, and indeed, even in hunts which have red coats, most people don't wear red coats, but yes.
All right.
And as I say, often hunting takes place on foot in hill packs, for example, in Wales and bits of the north and so on, and indeed beagling and basset hounds and mink and all the rest. It's a very complicated story. Fascinating.
Yes.
One of the reasons I like it so much is it's so complicated. But yes, it's a tradition of hunting is a traditional set of traditions, which was very alive until the ban, and very good mix of people in rural society. And had all sorts of benefits. And to some extent, those benefits have survived the ban because trail hunting still allows a lot of the pleasure and the communal aspects. But the sort of fundamental and beautiful thing about hunting is that you are getting two sets of animals, hounds and sometimes horses, who are sort of domesticated, and they're acting with a wild animal, usually a fox, sometimes a deer, And they're doing, the hounds are doing what they would naturally wish to do, which is chase and catch the fox. Mm. And that provides a service because you need to keep foxes under control. And it provides a pleasure because you've got the adventure of the chase. And this is sort of understood in absolutely all human societies until the 21st century, which seems to have forgotten it, in all human societies and at all times. Mm. So right back to very early wall paintings and so on, you see the hunt. And what you see is not only the hunt because you want to hunt to live, to eat the what you kill, but also, which, by the way, you wouldn't want to eat foxes, but also because the chase is a contest of, not exactly a contest, but an enactment of human courage and excitement and a way of getting to know the country and so on. So it's a very important part of, I'd say, of human civilization.
Well, because there's another group of people we have to put in the picture of the horses and the hounds and the men and women on top of the horses. There's also the hunt saboteurs, which became an important element in the picture of a Boxing Day hunt or whatever. So you must be aware of the arguments which would have been put to you repeatedly in discussions, but also actually out in the field, that this is an enjoyment that you're getting through what is essentially cruelty to animals, to be chasing after them and putting them to death.
I understand that argument. And, of course, if I thought it was true, I wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. I think it's quite easy to show to people who wish to listen that hunting is no more cruel than any other form of killing an animal, and much less cruel than most forms. And since it's generally recognised, they're not universally recognised, that there are circumstances in which you should kill animals, I don't see it as any moral problem at all, providing it's properly conducted. And hunting's always been good at that because it has its own rules, which it thinks carefully about. One of the things that's constantly alleged by anti-hunting people is that the fox is, quote, torn apart live. Mm-hmm. If that were true, I would not approve of it. It's torn apart dead. What happens, I watch it many times before the ban, is that the lead hound jumps on the fox and immediately breaks the back of his neck with its teeth. And it takes 5 seconds to die. Mm. And then it's torn apart dead because hounds like tearing the quarry apart. Not a pretty sight, but it's not cruel. It's dead.
Yeah, well, I take what you say about that, but that's a very particular issue as to whether the tearing happens before or after.
No, it's not a technicality. No, it's not a technicality because it's a question of the cruelty.
Yeah.
If the death is instantaneous, you see, it's almost impossible to wound a fox when you hunt them with hounds. You can easily wound a fox when you shoot, and it happens a great deal. And they can crawl away and they can die in agony days later. You can't. It's almost unheard of for hounds to wound a fox. There are normally about 30 hounds when they were hunting foxes, and each hound is bigger than one fox. So when 30 hounds are on a fox, it's dead, bang. And there's no question of it sort of limping off and struggling on in a miserable existence. So it's simply not the case that it's the act of killing it is cruel.
Well, I'll put an argument I'm sure you've heard before. There's a whole range of things that have been traditionally done with animals around the world, but certainly in this country, whether it's tying a bear and setting dogs on them, or
very different,
chasing rats around, or all those activities which were considered normal, and then somebody said, "Wait a minute, it's a bit cruel." And I suppose that's the context of if hunting is it's gone on for a long while, but isn't it a bit cruel? And the society, at any rate for the moment, has decided it's too cruel to justify.
You're right that society is, and it's right to do this, constantly asking what is cruel to animals and what isn't. And the view of that changes over time. So, for example, it seems to me to bait an animal or torment it is clearly cruel and indeed not allowed. But I'm convinced from long experience that that's not the case with hunting. And I rather suspect upsets me about saboteurs is that I don't think they want to know. I think they've decided it's wicked for sort of, to some extent, sort of pseudo-theological reasons, a sort of worship, sort of mistaken, misinterpreted worship of nature, and also for political and social reasons, that they think it represents a sort of hierarchy which is disgusting.
And it's posh blokes yes, on horses, trampling everywhere.
And that's wrong because though there are extremes of social privilege and deprivation among those who hunt, that is rather the point. So, and you fall off just as hard if you're a duke than as if you you know, unemployed and come from a council house. And hunting, unlike shooting, everybody who goes on a shoot, basically, you know, a shoot of eight people, private shoot, will be almost true to say fairly well off. At a hunt, they will be literally everything, because it's a sort of fraternity of people who enjoy the sport, and many of them who live in the, most of them live in the district and pursue all sorts of avocations and are very educated or totally uneducated or whatever. So it's a misrepresentation. And it's one of the things that I think is very important to maintain is the difference between country life and town life. I'm not against town life, and I've lived in town quite a long time in my life, but people should respect life in the country, and they should respect, they understand all its traditions that have been established. They can criticise them, but they do need to think about its context, and they should respect the people who know a lot about it. And this is true of, it's not just hunting nowadays, it's attitudes to farming, it's attitudes to do what you do with land, what you do with trees, what's right and wrong about animals, whether you eat them, how you slaughter them, and so on. And it's relevant to issues about housing and so on. And I think people have become rather intolerant about this because they're not very interested in the facts. They've got a sort of idea in their head which they wish to be confirmed. And country life doesn't have many spokesmen.
It's barbaric, it's unnecessary on all the grounds that the supporters profess. And it should be banished along with bear baiting, bull baiting, dog fighting, cock fighting, all of which used to be legitimate and lawful sports. It's strange. Everybody loves the countryside in Britain. Everybody loves it. Most people don't know how it works. They don't understand what goes on.
All right, so that's hunting. What's your fourth wonder, if we may?
Well, I thought about money, and I don't mean by that how lovely it is to have a pile of it and all that sort of thing. I'm just very fascinated by what money is, because it's all about, it seems to me a sort of classic thing about the nature of civilization, because it's remarkable the extent to which we trust it. And we don't completely trust it, as inflation is an index of a lack of trust in money, as a matter of fact. But how is it that we had developed the idea that, you know, what was originally, say, a piece of metal was worth something. And then we developed from that the idea that a piece of paper was worth something. And then we developed from that the idea that an online transaction was worth something. It's the most miraculous, I think, very civilized thing in which we sort of, we trust one another enough to have a common terms, rather like a common language. We accept a currency and we say, OK, I'm paid $20,000 a year and I accept that that's what I'm getting. And in turn, I will pay X for amount for at a shop. And people believe that. And of course, civilization very quickly collapses, as it did in Weimar Germany, if people don't believe that anymore. So you have runs on banks or you have hyperinflation. And we've got a bit near to that in recent years when people have somehow misunderstood or got frightened about money. And it's absolutely massive task of politicians and bankers and civilization generally to maintain trust in money. And all the words that relate to money are moral words, like value, for example, the word value, and equity, those sort of things. It's when it says money is what makes the world go round, this is true. And it's a very clever thing, and we take it for granted. Perhaps it's good that we do, because otherwise we'd be really terrified.
Well, I suppose we can see how it follows in degrees. You start with people, you know, bartering and swapping things. Then one of the things they swap is gold or silver, which is valuable and transportable and acceptable. The key step, I suppose, in what you're saying is that at some point they say, well, it's a bit of a bore to keep carrying the gold around. So a piece of paper that says, I promise to give you some gold or give you some silver, that'll do, won't it? And then, of course, when we enter the internet age, It's now just a click on a computer screen. But of course, it very nearly did come to an end with that monetary crisis, where because of I don't know whatever they were, the dodgy mortgages.
A bond, for example, is a promise to pay.
Yeah.
And therefore, if that promise is broken on any scale, nobody wants any bonds anymore. And if you're not careful, you go back to barter. So you need to build these more complicated instruments. It's a natural part of being a complicated civilization, but it's dangerous. And people need to think about that. One thing that money also reflects, which I find fascinating, is authority. That's to say, who's the boss? And in that famous moment in the New Testament when they bring the tribute money to Jesus, and they say, what should we do with this? Mm. He holds up the coin and he says, whose image and superscription is it? Mm. And they say, Caesar's. And then he says, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. Mm. And that's a sort of statement about political power and authority, and its limitations and its importance. That's why usually on a coin or a note, the authority is represented. The central bank and the sovereign. And crypto is a fascinating attempt to sort of get rid of that. I think it's a bit like Icarus flying too high. I think it's actually extremely dangerous. Because the confidence can collapse even more readily than confidence in a conventional currency. And then you're up the spout.
Well, we don't know when people are going to be listening to this. Crypto might be either up or down at a given time. But it's what you're... part of what you're saying, really, is that because money facilitates a system, it facilitates capitalism or even more fundamentally trade around the world. That's where the benefit lies in having money and its various
variants. Absolutely huge, because it can count for almost any transaction. Whereas obviously the great restriction of barter is lugging it around and whether it's relevant. So, you know, I may not want grapes in return for iron, let's say. And you know, then you have to... absolutely, it is absolutely marked. That's why it's a wonder of the world. And like most wonders, it has a certain fragility.
Yeah. I suppose it does. The fact that you've included that as one of your wonders of the world, you make a good case for it, but it does mark you out as somebody on the right of politics rather than left, because on the other side, people tend to see the horrors of it when there's too much accumulation of money and wealth amongst
they're right about that, by the way. I'm not in favour of a huge accumulation. I don't particularly mind a huge accumulation. I think it's very bad if wealth is inadequately distributed. I don't think governments are very good at distributing. I think it's better in a free market economy. It distributes widely by natural processes. But I absolutely agree with the great Adam Smith doctrine about no two men of the same trade are ever gathered together but to conspire against the public. And therefore, having the freest forms of currency will tend to make it easier for each individual human being. So I would have thought the left would be equally believing in the wonder of money, but I think they have an illusion about how the state can best direct the use of money. That's what we're worth, right?
I put it in the simplest form. I suppose the state could be there as a counterbalance to the accumulation of money. It can be by perfectly proper means, but at different times it's because oil was found on your land, or you invented a computer, or your electric car got away. And there are people with vast sums of money, some of whom go around the world building libraries or seeking a cure for malaria, but others don't. They just buy another yacht and pass it on to their friends and family.
Yes, well, in my view, there's no necessary virtue and no necessary vice in being rich. You may or may not be a good or bad person, just as in any other walk of life. So I don't think we should worship people with money, but neither do I think we should automatically denigrate them.
I just want to raise another issue, which I think is interrelated. This, the benefits of the growth of economy and industrialization, agriculture, all these things have come along, all connected with money coming along and allowing that. But we seem to be, to many people's eyes, to be hurtling towards a sort of doom if the world is consumed by climate change. And I notice that you're a, I don't know how you describe it. Sometimes people describe as climate deniers, but I think that's got a pejorative ring. But are you a sceptic that there is a problem about climate change? You're in an organisation that sort of doubts the fears that a lot of people express.
Actually, I'm not. As it happens, I'm not in that organisation. But I was, and I'm very happy that I was. And I just left it because I was too busy. But
this is the Global
Warming Policy Foundation. Yeah. But the clue is in the title, actually, because it's policy. I'm no scientist. I can't say exactly how serious the problem of global warming is in a scientific manner. But I think I can, like a lot of people, say something about the policy which governments produce. And I think that the policy of net zero specifically is crazy because it's arbitrarily set a date. There's nothing special about 2050. It's arbitrarily set a date by which X has to be achieved. And that will mean, and it already is meaning, that the price of energy shoots up. An enormous amount of money is wasted. And it makes vulnerable those powers who take the provisions most seriously and benefits the ones who don't take it seriously. So essentially, Britain in particular has made itself extremely vulnerable to countries like Russia or China, who have no intention of fulfilling the quotas, and both of whom are hostile to free society. And indeed, in the case of Putin, are busily trying to kill, literally working as hard as he can to kill as many Ukrainians as possible. And in the process, trying to deprive other countries of energy. So, one reason he's doing that, he's noticed our vulnerability because we got rid of fossil fuels before we were ready to. I'm not particularly sticking up for fossil fuels. I simply point out that you have to have them because of the problem of intermittency until such time as you solve that problem. And the idea that we should get along without them and just suffer is terrifying and totally unnecessary. It's not the total contribution Britain makes to carbon emissions is something like 1% of the global total. So if we behaved with what's seen as the most unbelievable virtue and actually reduced our carbon production, we would make no difference to the future of the planet, whatever, but we would impoverish ourselves. And to some extent, we already have.
All right. Well, I understand what you're saying there, but the thing about having an arbitrary aim point, a target of reducing emissions or so forth, is if you don't have something like that, then there's always going to be somebody to say, we've had all these sort of policies that we'll raise the tax on this. And as soon as there's any sort of financial problem or a difficulty, they say, we won't bother with that for the moment. For the moment, we'll keep having coal, or for the moment, we'll keep having oil. For the moment, and then it may, and some people argue, we've already gone past this point. It may be too late, and that
first of all, I think it's very dangerous for them to argue if it's too late, because if it's too late, it's too late. So they might as well shut up. And they've had it. We've had it. But I don't believe that at all. I think that the way this will work is that, as has worked throughout industrial civilization, is that it can solve problems. Some of those problems are created by industrial civilization, but technology will find a way, and indeed is finding a way. And indeed, wind technology, for example, is one of those ways. I don't think it's as important as some people say. But I'm very against, Clive, is not. I am in favour of being worried about the climate. I am very against catastrophizing problems.
Yeah.
And I'm very suspicious of the motives people who are so keen to do so. And I notice that what they're trying to do when they do that is acquire more power over the citizen and reduce the freedom of the citizen, and particularly actually the poorer citizen, for whom energy is a much higher percentage of their total spending.
I think I've taken you off the central feature of money, but I thought that was can I gather from that you do accept that human activity has warmed the climate and there is something that we have to address at some time or another?
Yes, so even there I would be a little bit cautious because I'm not convinced that every aspect of global warming is bad. So, for example, round us in Sussex, southern England, there are now lots of very successful vineyards, and they couldn't have existed when it was considerably colder. That would seem to me in itself a benefit. Now, there will be counter disbenefits for others, but I just make that point because it's not obvious that every single thing is made worse by this phenomenon.
Well, yeah, you made that's a pretty minor benefit, though. If
well, no, no, but it's just an example.
Sahara,
no.
I know. But if the Sahara expands, seawater rises, so you know parts of London are washed away, and the Gulf Stream starts working, we go cold again.
Right, but this has happened before. So I live in an area where the sea used to come right up almost to where we live, which is now 10 miles from the sea. And I don't think, you know, we've suffered enormous harm because of that, and we've suffered some, we've got some benefits.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, let's move on to perhaps a more again, it's a traditional thing, possibly, but it's rectories. I think I grasp the difference between a rectory and a vicarage, and the difference between a rector and a vicar, but that may not be important. It's the houses that rectors live in, or at any rate used to live in.
Yes, both live in and used to live in, I mean, like old and current ones. I set up this... We live in an old rectory, my wife and I, and as you say, there are, for various reasons, I won't bore anyone with the difference between rectories and vicarages, but our society embraces all clergy houses of all description and all denominations, presbyteries, parsonages, deaneries, bishops' palaces,
the manse.
Whatever.
Yeah.
The manse, exactly. Yeah. And the point is that, particularly, I think, in the Church of England, they have such multiple importance, architectural, horticultural, literary, ecclesiastical, social, agricultural, because they're so built into communities, particularly rural communities, but actually also to some extent urban ones. And because in the old days people didn't have village halls and church halls and that sort of thing, they were also great communal gathering places, because the vicar would have you to his party, to a party in his garden, or he would meet parishioners in quite a large room in what tended to be a relatively large house. Their role in the intellectual life of this country is phenomenal, because basically the Church of England, unlike a lot of, say, the Catholic Church, had all their clergy were educated. So slightly stopped doing that now, but it used to be a requirement that all vicars could understand Latin and hold degrees. Therefore, what happened was that a lot of rectors and vicars had families which were very clever and very literary and sitting often in quite remote places, as it were, making their own entertainment. A classic would be, of all, the classic one, I suppose, would be the Bronte sisters.
In a
pretty grim vicarage in the pretty cold part of Yorkshire, and writing these extraordinary fictions. But it's also true of Jane Austen or Tennyson or Laurence Olivier. I mean, really, the list goes on and on and on. And Laurence Olivier is interesting just because there's also a theatrical overlap, I think, in that clergy performance in church is quite like acting.
Sure.
And so if you want the sort of genealogy of how the British, particularly the English, thought about, well, actually in the Scots, but in a different way, thought about things and how their creative imaginations, you would need to study these places and what happened in them and how they lived and what they read. And the other thing that's so interesting about them is that people don't know them very well, because very rarely are they open to the public. They're not like great houses of the National Trust, but they're jolly interesting, and they date, some of them are medieval and many of them are 18th century and Victorian. And we go on, our society, the Rectory Society, goes on visits. You don't have to own, it's not an owner's club, by the way, anybody can join. And it's absolutely fascinating to me, and their relationship with the church, and they're often very beautiful, and they're sort of hidden gems, I would say.
You say they're not like country houses, but they do often seem to be quite substantial properties for what might have been quite a small parish. There seemed to be room for, you know, the rector, his wife, a few children, and a few servants as well.
Well, they varied. The truth is they varied enormously, and this is very well portrayed by Trollope in his novels, because in the old days, different parishes had different endowments to do with the amount of glebe land they could get and tithe they could collect.
Yeah.
And so some were super rich. I mean, some of them used to earn 10,000 a year in 1840, which is like earning, several million pounds now. And some used to be pretty well worthless. And so some of the clergy, because they would take the income, were absolutely on the take, really. I mean, they had the most extraordinary luck, and it was often to do with being the squire's younger son or something like that. Mm. But then there would be the people like, I think he's called Mr. Crawley in Trollope, the perpetual curate of Hogglestock, who's doing the work for 100 quid a year, while the grander fellow's doing very little for much more. So the consequences are great architectural distinctions. And some, particularly in Wales, are charmingly modest, and some are, particularly in England, are sort of preposterously grand. And there's a great range between that.
Now we come on to your sixth wonder, which again is one that perhaps marks you out as your political thinking pretty firmly.
Well, yes, Margaret Thatcher. It's true that I would be broadly sympathetic to Mrs. Thatcher's politics, but actually I think people on the left often regard Margaret Thatcher as a wonder of the world, because Tony Benn used to say it, and so did Arthur Scargill, that why can't we have somebody who stands up for our side as well as she does for hers?
Yes.
So what they were acknowledging was a really remarkable, and I think this is the key point, there's nothing really to do with whether you agree with her or not, a really, really remarkable character and a really, really remarkable leader. And, of course, in the context of the time, and still now, actually, a very, very remarkable woman. Mm-hmm. These seem to me undeniable, even if you can't stand her. And that's the sort of wonder of it. That's why it's really very extraordinary.
Yes.
And because I wrote the authorised biography and therefore spent an enormous 22 years, and, not all that time, of course, because I was still a journalist, but... was the first person to see vast, vast numbers of documents, I got a very strong sense of how she did this, both how she got to the top and how she stayed at the top, and how she worked and how she thought about things. And it is a very, very extraordinary story, there's no doubt about it. And her, not least of it, her unbelievable diligence. So her mastery of detail without losing sight of the big picture is unique, definitely unique. And so is her capacity to change the sort of language and agenda of issues. And so was her innovation, both in policy and in presence, physical and human presence, because of taking advantage of being the first really important woman in I mean, there were some important ones before, but the first really, really important woman in British politics.
Yeah.
And therefore, making being totally distinctive. And that's, this is, to me, fascinating, and I think it is a wonder of the world, actually.
Well, I take your point, saying that whether you're for or against her, she made an impact, because often when things are discussed nowadays, she'll either be given the credit for having done something all those years ago, or the blame for the way things are.
Or both.
And
indeed, right now, this is very germane because of we're suddenly getting back to strikes again.
Yes.
And she got strikes down from 22.2 million working days in 1979 to 1.8 million working days in 1990. And we're just creeping back up to the latter figure.
Yeah.
The whole time since then, as a result of her changes, the strikes have been unbelievably low.
But just in terms of, let's say, limited to post-war prime ministers, I mean, to be brutally frank, I mean, brutally about them, some just come and go, and they hardly have left a footprint in the sand. But I suppose, I mean, you'd know better than I would, but I would say you've got to give credit to Attlee and to Thatcher and to Blair, each of whom had their effect in different ways. And where would you rank? Well, would you agree with that as the three that you would pick out from the post-war? And where would you put her in the context of those three?
I would agree with that, though I might give a little honourable mention to Macmillan as well.
Yes.
And but I would, and I think those three are all very important. But you see, what she had was the qualities of Attlee and of Blair. So Attlee was uncharismatic, but very determined to achieve certain things. Mm. And Blair was charismatic, but not that interested in what he actually did. And she had the charisma and the determination to achieve certain things. So, and I think that makes her more successful than either of the two you've mentioned, though they were in many ways successful. And this is shown by the fact that she kept on winning elections. So she had more time even than Blair to do things. She was at the top for 11 and a half years, quite absolutely unparalleled in the age of universal suffrage. And that made her capacity to bring about change, for better or for worse, unique. And that itself is a remarkable thing.
Would you say, I mean, this is not to praise or criticise her, but she was, in some senses, lucky because she had two things going in her favour. Early on in her career as Prime Minister, the Falklands War came along. Now, if it hadn't come along, possibly she wouldn't have won the next election. If the war had been lost, which it must have come quite close to being, she'd have been finished. And then she had the Labour Party dividing itself while she was in power. And again, that played into her hands. Now, you're not in control of that sort of thing necessarily as Prime Minister. Do you see what I'm suggesting?
Well, absolutely. That all, the best image of politics is one given by Michael Oakeshott, which is that you're, even the best leader is not very powerful because they're like the captain of a ship where the most powerful thing is the sea. Mm. And you know, if there's a really big storm, you can be the best captain in the world and that's that.
Mm.
So that's true. But, and Mrs. Thatcher certainly had some luck, but I believe that only she could have won the Falklands War. I don't think any other male politician would have taken it on. And I also think that you talk about the Labour Party being in a mess with Michael Foot, perfectly true. But she knew how to exploit that. She could see how they didn't understand her. And
yes.
What the Labour Party did, and Tony Blair is very strong on this. I've talked to him about it a lot. He told me a lot about it. He thought the Labour Party could only graduate to power if it could recognise the immense achievements of Margaret Thatcher. And he said it's no good, Neil Kinnock or Michael Foot, just saying how wicked Margaret Thatcher is. They have to show, the public are not interested in that, they have to show that they would do better than her. And they can only do that, said Blair, paradoxically, if they will accept that she's done quite a lot of good things. And he's completely right about that. And that's why one of the reasons he won. He incorporated a lot of Thatcher. And so I think she was very instrumental in the weakness of the Labour Party in her era.
Now, you wrote Margaret Thatcher's biography. I mean, I don't think you've done a lot of biographies, but a lot of people write biographies of historical figures, and they come to them entirely through their papers and or what was written up about them by other people. Of course, you would have met Margaret Thatcher and had dealings with her quite a lot in her lifetime. Did your opinion of her change once you got into the papers and doing the research?
Well, it didn't perhaps fundamentally change, but it altered in some respects. Perhaps two I would mention. One is that I understood better how incredibly difficult she could be. And I didn't actually suffer from this personally very much, but I did understand why people like Geoffrey Howe and Nigel Lawson and let alone Michael Heseltine were sort of driven mad by her. Partly just because she was still hanging around when they were longing to get power themselves, but also because she's a bit like that nursery rhyme or what story about, you know, I'll do it myself, says the little red hen. She would accumulate things to herself, and she found it very difficult to share with colleagues. And also she was no respecter of persons, so she would be much politer to the junior person than the senior person, which was very, very upsetting for the senior person. and actually quite difficult for the junior person sometimes, because that made the senior person hate the junior person. So that's important, I think. And the other thing, though, was that I was even more impressed by her in this sense, that I understood better how unbelievably difficult it had been for her to get to the top as a woman. The loneliness and the sacrifice of working your way up for 25 years within the Conservative Party was absolutely amazing. And right the way through, even to the end, she was still being patronised and excluded. She never really got to know the House of Commons because it was so male.
What about the, and you know, you all know the criticism of her, I'm sure you've dealt with this a lot, but, you know, she, what brought her down, I suppose, more than anything was her stubbornness. She stuck with the poll tax policy, even though everyone was throwing brickbats at her. But throughout when her, she would call it, I suppose, successful period of time, there was the hardness to her that meant she could contemplate, you know, mining villages being closed or policies of deindustrialisation. What gave her the strength, if that's the right word for that, as opposed to, I don't know, somebody like Michael Heseltine or Edward Heath or somebody would have probably balked at some of those harsh decisions?
Well, actually, I think, funnily enough, Heseltine might not have, but Heath would. But I don't really agree with the hardness point. You see, she looked at the moral, she was a very moral person, interested in morality, but she looked at it in a different way. So what she saw with a miners' strike was, remember, there was never a ballot for the miners' strike. So what she saw was an extreme left Arthur Scargill who was trying to overthrow the elected government, which was true. He was. He even said he was. And trying to force miners to go on strike and lose their earnings and their work, whereas she, in her view, had a plan to make the mining industry more rational. And in particular, she was very, very concerned about the working miners, those who continued to work because there was no ballot, and they were very annoyed with Scargill. And they, even at the beginning of the strike, they were about 30% of the workforce, and they rose as the strike went on. And she hated the violence and intimidation that they suffered and their wives suffered from Scargill's thugs. And so she saw this as a moral battle. It wasn't a sort of, oh, it doesn't matter what happens to these people because I'm going to do what I want to do. Not at all. It was, in her view, it was the right people winning against the bad and extreme people. So you may disagree with that, but I think one has to respect that as a motive. She wasn't callous. She was tough, not the same thing.
Well, yes, I put it in tough terms, but I think callous is the word that other people would use. Because if you're in a mining village and you're the wife of a miner and having to find food for your children, the fact that the dispute is about whether Scargill took the vote or not fades into the background, doesn't it?
No, it isn't, because somebody's got to win. He started the dispute, and if he won, it would have been catastrophic for the whole country and indeed for for a lot of miners. So I think, she understood the importance of sticking by something that you believe to be important, and she carefully planned to resist the Scargill onslaught, and she didn't relish it, but she did have to do it.
Prime Minister, are you and the Coal Board insisting on a written surrender by Mr. Scargill before any talks about the coal strike can begin?
No. I think what we're insisting on having been through seven rounds of talks already, is a clear basis on which the talks can start. There are a lot of people interested in these talks. I'm anxious that if they're entered into, they should be a success. We've got the interest of the working miners to consider, 78,000 of them. We mustn't let them down. They haven't let the industry down.
All right, so that's your sixth wonder. We've got one final wonder to do, which is perhaps less controversial than Margaret Thatcher. What's your final wonder?
Well, I don't know if it is less controversial. Breakfast, about which people feel very strongly. And the reason breakfast interests me, apart from a great love of all meals, is that it's so different. So all its etiquette and rules are the opposite of other meals. So if you at the same lunch every day, it's considered to show that you're extremely weird. And Dominic Raab, for example, is accused of always having the same lunch every day from Pret-a-Manger. It's almost considered that he should be dismissed from office because of this. Whereas we're all perfectly happy to eat the same breakfast every day. And I have a special little variation because I spend most of my nights in Sussex and one or two in London. So when I'm in London, I daringly go out to a cafe and have porridge, which I don't have at home. Otherwise, I eat exactly the same thing every day for breakfast. And I think most people do that. And also, and that's somehow very soothing. It's a very soothing meal, I find, if you've got certainly if you've got enough time. And I take a lot of time over it because I use it to read the papers and catch up with what's going on. It's therefore also not necessarily, and indeed not usually, sociable. So on the whole, lunch is a time when you talk to people, and supper is a time to either family or colleagues or whatever. And breakfast, it's entirely understood that the most you would do is grunt and ask for something to be passed to you.
This is a theory of mine, is that it's a sort of patriotic meal in that for most people in Britain, if you go out for a meal at lunchtime or in the evening, you'll almost certainly want to go to, it might be an Italian restaurant, Indian restaurant, a Chinese restaurant. You'll eat what people around the world who go to restaurants eat in restaurants. And you might, as a variant, think of some quaint British thing. But if you are in an international hotel and breakfast is all laid out, British people will naturally go for, it might be porridge, it might be toast, it might be bacon and egg, but they won't go and have a piece of Dutch cheese or whatever else.
I think it's a very, very good theory, though it's slightly pricked by the croissant.
It's a bit like accepting hops, you know. It's taken a few years, and we now like croissants.
It's the only, it is the only meal where you English is a form of advertisement. So you say the full English breakfast. You wouldn't say the full English lunch or the full English dinner, would you?
No.
No, you're right about that. And like a lot of full English things, it actually depends on masses of things that come from the rest of the world, like tea, coffee, oranges.
Well, of course. Charles, I've taken a long time, more than I was expecting to do, but I've got dragged you into more and more conversation. Obviously, my wonder of the world is anything that would rid me of this sore throat, but I haven't got it yet. So what I have to do is to thank you for sharing your seven wonders with me, but I have to choose the wonder of wonders from your list of seven, the one which struck me as particularly wonderful as you described it on this podcast. And I think it's been quite difficult. I had in mind to be controversial. I would go for one of your more controversial ones to mark it out on our list. But then I thought no, breakfast would be the most charming. But I think I'll go of your seven. I think I'll go with the Fleet Street because I have a sort of nostalgic idea of what Fleet Street, the street, was like, having worked near there, and an improved Fleet Street surviving. Maybe online with proper reporting, with a bit of American fact checking as well. I'll make that your wonder of wonders, which I think goes with you and your career as well.
Thank you, Clive. Thanks. Get well soon.
If you enjoyed this episode of My Seven Wonders, it will.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you found us. Thank you for listening.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.